ॐ सहनाववतु सहनौ भुनक्तु सहवीर्यङ्करवावहै तेजस्विनावधीतमस्तु मा विद्विषावहै ॐ शान्ति शान्ति शान्तिः नारायणं नमस्कृत्य नरं चैव नरोत्तमं देवीं सरस्वतीं चैव ततो जयमुदीरयेत्। ॐ Excuse me, good. Welcome back. For the last several classes, we have continued in the portion of the Ashwamedha Parva, known as Anu Gita. This is the Gita that follows the Bhagavad Gita, which occurred way back in the sixth book of the Mahabharata. And what distinguishes the Anu Gita, as we discussed before, is that the Bhagavad Gita is narrated by Sri Krishna, and the Anu Gita is narrated by a very wise Brahmana. And that's what we're seeing, is a narration of this very wise Brahmana, who is going to tell us this wonderful story of Alarka. I'll introduce Alarka in just a moment, but before, you might remember in the last class we saw this extended metaphor. And we talked about the poetic nature of the Mahabharata as the world's longest epic poem by a big measure. And when we say poem, it uses a lot of poetry. Of course, when you see it in English, you may not appreciate the poetry. And some portions of it are more poetic than others. I think there are some pretty gruesome descriptions of the battle, which are not terribly poetic. They're just very in your face, as they say in this country. But the last section we just saw was very poetic in its extended use of metaphor. The whole chapter was like a long metaphor. Today, we're going to get another chapter that uses another poetic device. I don't know how you feel about literature. When I was in school, I hated it. But they taught us all of this stuff, and they told us that among literary devices, metaphor is one and allegory is another. And what we're going to see today is an allegory. Metaphor, you understand what it is. Allegory, just in case you don't know, is like a, I don't know, how to describe allegory? A fictitious story which is used to teach something. An allegory, that's not a bad definition. An allegory is a fictitious story that is used for the sake of teaching. And that's what we're going to see today, is an allegory about Alarka, which means it's not, Alarka is being presented as an allegorical character, not necessarily a real character. And the reason I say it's an allegory is, you will see fairly shortly, it's the whole chapter is a dialogue between Alarka and his mind, his intellect, his senses, etc. So he has a conversation with his nose. Now, generally, people don't have conversations with their noses, but this is it's in the context of this allegorical story. Okay, enough said. Before we plunge in, the choice of the name Alarka is significant because Alarka has the two, the first, Alarka, like any word, many meanings. The first two meanings for Alarka are, one, a mad dog, and two, a furious person. So that gives you some idea about who Alarka is. Probably not very easygoing. More likely someone who's struggling with anger. In fact, one of the purposes of this chapter is to give instruction for anyone who might be struggling with anger issues. Those issues are dealt with quite nicely in this chapter. We'll see that as we go along. So let us see the allegorical story of Alarka as narrated by this Brahmana. So it just begins. So this is the Brahmana's narration. Alarko nama rajarshir, Alarko nama abhavatsu mahatapaha, abhavatsu dharmagnya satya sandhascha, dharmagnya satya sandhascha, mahatma sumahavrataha, mahatma sumahavrataha. Alarkaha nama, there was a person who by name was Alarka, and he was a Rajarshi. Rajarshi is a combination of the two words Raja and Rishi. When you put the two words together, they become Rajarshi. So he was a Raja. Literally, he ruled a kingdom. To rule a kingdom means you own the kingdom. He is a Raja, he is a king. And Rishi means he's wise, not an ordinary Raja. In fact, most Rajas seem to be not wise. Most Rajas seem to be otherwise. But this Raja was definitely wise. Abhavat, he was sumahatapaha. He was given to great tapas, great penances, great austerities. How many rajas are given to great austerities? I don't think so. So this is a very unusual king who is extremely spiritual in his orientation to such an extent that he practiced great austerities. He was dharmagnaha. He understood and practiced dharma. He was satyasandaha. He was committed to satya, to truth. He always was truthful. Mahatma. We just saw that in our Kathopanishad class. A nice Mahatma has different meanings in different contexts. We saw it in the Kathopanishad in the sense of someone who is big-hearted. And it seems to have that meaning here as well. Mahatma in the sense of big-hearted. One whose atma doesn't always mean consciousness. So atma can have several meanings. Here, take it as one who is big-hearted in a sense of generous. It would be a nice meaning for it. Or a conventional meaning is also okay. And he was sumahavrataha. He was given to very intense vratas, vows and spiritual practices. So you get the sense from this introductory verse that he was no ordinary Raja by any means. He was an intensely spiritual person. And stitasya vriksha mule ta, stitasya vriksha mule, tasya chinta babhuvaha, tasya chinta babhu, utsrijya sumahad Rajam utsrijya sumahadrajam sukshmam pratimahamate, sukshmam pratimahamate. Start in a second line. Tasya, for him, for Alarka. Chinta bhuva. There were some concerns arose in his mind, chinta, thinking. Chinta bhavuva, some thinking arose in his mind, tasya, for him, when, stitasya, when he was sitting, vriksha mule, at the root of a tree, ata, at that time, vriksha mule, while he was stitasya sitting, vriksha mule, at the foot of a tree, tasya chinta bhavuva, he started thinking. What kind of thinking? Utsrijya, turning away from, sumahat rajam, from his great kingdom, His vast king. So Mahat means great. Mahat Rajam, big kingdom. Sumahat Rajam, a really big kingdom. So it wasn't one of these little, nothing small. So this really big kingdom he was the king of, but his mind, Utsrajya, turned away from his thinking about his great kingdom, and sukshmam prati, and turned towards matters which were sukshma, subtle. So code word for spiritual. So his mind turned away from his administrative responsibilities back at the palace. Remember, he's now sitting at the foot of a tree outside of the palace. And sitting at the foot of the tree, this has happened to you as well. Your mind relaxes and you let go of all your ordinary mundane concerns, and your mind being free turns to higher matters. So his mind, becoming freed from his mundane responsibilities of the kingdom, turns towards subtle matters, turns towards spiritual things. Mahamate, here the Brahmana is addressing someone. I'm not sure if it's Krishna. I didn't see the context. So Mahamate, O wise one, the Brahmana is narrating this story, maybe to Krishna, but maybe to someone else. Could be a different context. Doesn't make any difference. Anyway, so the Brahmana narrates the story about Alarka, and now what does Alarka say? So his mind has turned away from the kingdom, and he starts pondering spiritual matters, and Alarka uvacha, Alarka manaso me balam jatam, manaso me balam mano jitva dhruvo jayaha, mano jitva dhruvo jaya anyatra bhan, anyatra banana syami, anyatra banana syami, shatrubhi parivaritaha, shatrubhi pari banan asyami. We'll see that in a moment. So he says, me manaha, so Alarka now is talking. Talking to whom? He's sitting at the foot of a tree. He's not talking to the tree. He's talking to himself. So talking to himself, he says out loud, manasaha me, my manas, my mind, balam jatam, has become very strong. Very strong meaning too strong. I think it appears here that, and there's not a lot of detail here, so we can try to read in between the lines. He's called Alarka, the mad dog, and maybe he's finally recognizing the source of his anger coming from his mind, and he says, balam jatam, my mind has become too strong, too difficult to control, too difficult to deal with. And here is this Rajarshi. As Raja, as king, how do you become the king, not of a big kingdom, but the king of a really big kingdom, Sumahat Rajam? You might become the king of a big kingdom if your father was a king and you inherit the kingdom, but you become the king of a really big kingdom by conquering kingdoms around you. So we have to read between the lines a lot here to get the whole story. So he became the king of a really big kingdom by conquering foes, by conquering those who ruled adjacent kingdoms. And so he's accustomed to being the conqueror, certainly is not accustomed to being conquered. So he says here, manaha jitva, if I can conquer my mind, then dhruvaha jayaha, that's a real victory. Very interesting. So he's conquered so many foes in his life. He's conquered the adjacent, he's overtaken adjacent kingdoms. He's conquered everything in life except for one thing. His own mind. In particular, he hasn't been able to conquer his anger. His anger remains unconquered. And he admits this. He says, if I can conquer, so is manaha jitva, the idea is if I can conquer my mind, dhruvam jayaha, that would be a real victory. Then he goes on to say, banan asyami, bana is arrow, asyami, I will shoot my arrows anyatra, elsewhere. Interesting expression. He's accustomed to shooting his arrows at his enemies. And apparently he's been pretty successful. He's conquered his enemies and he's attained all the nearby kingdoms. So now he's starting to reconsider his purpose in life. He's conquered some, he's conquered all the end. There's no one left to conquer except for his own anger. Interesting turning point in life. And the whole point of an allegorical story like this is to represent certain aspects of our own lives. And there comes a point in life when, like Alarka has already conquered all of his external enemies, and now he turns to conquer the internal enemy. Similarly, there comes a time in life when you're well settled. Well settled means, you know, you have a job, you have a house, you have a family, you have all the stuff you're supposed to have. So you've conquered all those challenges of life, but maybe you haven't conquered certain aspects of your own mind. And how significant it is that, how to put it more bluntly, we're not in control of our own minds. Who is master and who is servant? Are you in charge or your mind in charge? It depends. In many situations, you're in charge. Good. But there are certain situations where you're not in control. Like when someone insults you, you get very angry and you fire back an even worse insult using language you would never use in any other situation. So when you fire back that terrible insult using foul language that you generally don't use, who chose to do that? You or your mind? Right? So that's just a simple example of a time in which you're not in control of your mind. The mind is the master and you're the servant. The mind is using your mouth, so to speak, to blast this foul language at someone. So what a ridiculous situation. You're blessed with a mind. That mind is going to be your close companion for your entire life. Already it's been around for a long time. And it's going to be around for however much longer we have. So your mind is a lifelong companion. What kind of companion is it? Is it a pleasant companion? Imagine being on a long journey. Some of you have gone to this Mount Kailash. Wonderful. Yatra. Takes 2 weeks. So you're going up into the mountains, sitting in... I handed to you those who have gone because you have to sit in a jeep for about 2 weeks bouncing along these roads in Tibet. And to me that sounds very difficult. Anyway, so you're sitting in this jeep with several companions. Suppose there are some really obnoxious people and you're stuck with them. You're stuck, even though you're on this wonderful yatra to this holy place in Tibet, you're stuck with these obnoxious companions in this jeep, and there's nowhere else to go. You're sitting in a jeep, 2 more weeks sitting in this jeep, coming and going to Mount Kailash. That's just 2 weeks. If dealing with an obnoxious companion for 2 weeks is difficult, what if your mind is an obnoxious companion? And you have to deal with that obnoxious companion not for 2 weeks, but for your lifetime. This is the setup. And Alarka exactly has that problem. He says his mind is balam jatam. It's become too strong, too arrogant. It becomes too angry, and it's too forceful, and it becomes the master, and he becomes a servant. So he's reached a stage of life where he wants to deal with that. As I said many times, you reach a stage of life when other external matters have been more or less taken care of. It's time to deal with these internal matters. It's time to be more devoted to a life of emotional and spiritual growth. Both. Not just one or the other. Emotional growth with no spiritual growth, or spiritual growth with no emotional growth, both are incomplete. They should certainly go together, emotional growth and spiritual growth. And you can, at some point in life, you can recognize the necessity of doing that. Some people recognize it earlier in life. Some people recognize that necessity for emotional and spiritual growth later in life. Some people never recognize it at all and then lose out on many opportunities for that emotional and spiritual growth. Anyway, sitting at the foot of the tree, Alarka has recognized his need to deal with his anger issues, to deal with his mind, and he decides to deal with it directly. And directly use... directly, but using the means he's used to. So no, he's used to conquering his foes by force, by strength, arrows. So, and that's kind of the only way he knows to conquer his enemies. All of his other enemies he's conquered with arrows and force. That's why now he says, banan asyami, now I will, us is to throw. Now I will shoot my arrows anyatra, at other enemies. What enemy? Anger. He's going to use arrows to conquer his problem of anger. Shatru bihi parivaritaha. Parivaritaha, even though he is, parivarita means surrounded. Even though he is surrounded, shatru bihi, with other enemies. So apparently he's conquered those kingdoms immediately around him, but then when your kingdom grows from this big to this big, now your boundary is here and you got more enemies out here. So he is still surrounded by enemies. He is shatrubihi parivaritaha. He continues to be surrounded by external enemies, but he makes a commitment now to direct his effort not towards external enemies, to direct his effort towards the internal enemy. The internal enemy is his mind in general and anger in particular. And yadidam chapalhan murtehe, yadidam chapalhan sarvam etat chikirshati, sarvam etat chikir mana pratisutikshnagran, mana pratisutikshna, aham mokshyami sayakan, aham mokshyami sayakan. He's talking about his mind. Remember, he's speaking to himself. And he says, yat idam, this mind of mine, this mind of mine, go down a line, etat, this mind of mine, chikirshati, sarvam chikirshati. Shikirshati, it wants, it desires, sarvam, everything. This mind of mine wants everything. Chapalat murtehe. You have to break the words apart properly. Chapalat means fickle. Chapalat, due to its fickleness, murtehe, of its form, of its nature. Due to the fickle nature of my mind, it wants everything. Fickle nature means what? After conquering the enemy to the east, he decides to conquer the enemy to the west, then the enemy to the south and north, and this one and that one and the other one. It goes on, and that and this is an allegory. Excuse me. So he says, my mind wants everything. My mind wants to conquer more and more enemies. My mind wants a bigger and bigger kingdom. Where does it stop? So if his kingdom is this big and he conquers enemies to the north, south, east, and west, then his kingdom becomes this big. But now there are new enemies, north, south, east, and west. He can conquer them. His kingdom now becomes this big. Yet there are more enemies, north, south, east, and west. You get the idea. It is endless. And no matter how many victories he has accomplished, his mind wants more. Give me more, 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 more. Problem. Problem for anyone and everyone in life, where is contentment if we always want more? We've spoken several times in the past how desire is often compared to a fire. You put wood in a fire, and the fire consumes the wood. Like you give enjoyment to your mind, and the mind consumes that enjoyment, so to speak. You put more wood in the fire consumes more wood. You put more enjoyment into your mind enjoys all that. If you keep putting wood into the fire, when will the fire have enough wood? When will the fire be like satisfied or content with the amount of wood you've put in? Never happen, right? The more wood you put in the fire, the more it consumes, the more enjoyments you feed your mind, so to speak, the more it wants. It's this endless cycle of enjoyment and desire, enjoyment and desire. Enjoyment is like the wood that feeds the fire. You put in more wood, the fire grows bigger, and the bigger fire is ready to consume even more wood. So here, Alarka recognizes that problem with his mind, which he says, balam jatam, it's grown too strong. And etat sarvam chikirshati, it wants everything. It's never satisfied. Chapalat murtehe, due to its unsteady nature. It just will keep going from one thing to another, to another, to another. To another. Therefore, what should he do? In the last line, he says his solution to the problem, aham, I, mokshyami. By the way, be careful this, you're saying, oh, moksha. No, no. The root is to free. And here, what he's going to free, he says, aham, mokshyami, I will free, not himself, I'm going to free. Here the word sayakam is used for arrow. Previously bana, now sayaka. I'm going to free my arrows. Free the arrows doesn't mean set them free. To free the arrows means to shoot the arrows. So aham mokshyami, I'm going to shoot sayakam, arrows. What kind of arrows? Sutikshna agran. Arrows whose agra, with tips, that are sutikshna, very, very sharp. So I'm going to fire my very sharp-tipped arrows where? Manaha prati, towards my mind. Huh? Remember, it's an allegory. So I'm going to shoot my sharp arrows towards my mind. He's, throughout his life, he's used his sharp arrows to defeat all his other enemies. Now he's confronting his anger and his mind. So if arrows work so well for his other enemies, then they should work well against his mind. This shows a problem. A problem that we all have this little, not tunnel vision, more conditioned thinking. We get into a rut in our thinking. What we've done, what has worked for us before, should work for us in the future. Whatever has worked for you in your past, well, you're going to continue using that in the future. Problem is, we haven't reflected perhaps on the defects of our past. So if we think that we've been so successful in the past, we're going to take our past strategies, apply them to the future, but turns out that our past strategies maybe weren't so good. Specifically, he used force to deal with his external enemies. Now he's going to use force to deal with his mind. And maybe that's not a good strategy. Why is it not a good strategy? When somebody else forces you to do something, how do you feel? You resist, right? No one wants to be forced to do anything. We get angry, we get frustrated, we resist. So when you try to use force on your own mind, your mind is going to resist. It's a lousy strategy to try to win your mind through force and force alone. I was just teaching this to teenagers, introducing meditation to teenagers. It's a nice topic, and an important topic for teens and adults, obviously. But what I was telling them is the way to make your mind quiet is not force. And I gave the metaphor, an example. Many of these teens have done babysitting either for siblings or for cousins or neighbors, etc. Suppose you're babysitting a one-year-old and the one-year-old is crying and crying and crying. So how are you going to deal with that one-year-old? By force? You're going to shout at the one-year-old, "Shut up!" That's not a very successful strategy, right? That is the forceful approach, which may be successful in other circumstances, but that strategy is doomed to failure with the one-year-old. It's an apt metaphor because sometimes our minds behave like one-year-old. He complained in the first half of the verse that his mind kept wanting more and more and more. That's like a child. You give a child a cookie, "Can I have another? Give him another. Can I have another, please? Another, another." If a child is asking for cookies, when will the child get enough? Go on asking for more and more and more. Our minds are like that, like a child who wants more and more. The point is, if the mind is like a child, that forceful approach with a child is not going to be effective. That forceful approach with our minds is not going to be effective. But this Alarika, as this mighty warrior, the only technique he knows is force. And so he's ready to use force on his mind. It's all he knows. This is how we see the world from our own perspectives. I have to tell you this anecdote. I've told this many years. A few of you may remember this. Really, really telling. This is probably 30 years ago or more. I had a problem with chronic headaches. I didn't know what to do. Every single day, Every morning, I would have a, shortly after waking up, I'd have a headache. Every day, day after day after day. One of my students was a neurologist. How convenient. He says, yeah, Swamiji, come to my office, we'll do a neurological workup and we'll find out what's going on with your headaches. So I went to his office, he does all this neurological testing, I think it was an MRI and all of this stuff. And he says, Swamiji, I think you're getting migraines. And the treatment he prescribed was a medication called a beta blocker. So a beta blocker, I don't know all the medicine, but all I know is it worked immediately. So I started taking the beta blocker, it worked. After 2 weeks, the headaches came back. He said, double the amount of beta blocker. Worked for another 2 weeks. Then he said, take that after 2 weeks, and a month has gone by. He says, you know, you can take even more. Because apparently I started with a small dose. I'm taking more and more beta blocker. Well, eventually, you see where this is going. The beta blocker wasn't solving the problem. The beta blocker was removing the symptom. But that's how a neurologist looks at me. So the neurologist looked at me like a brain and central nervous system that needs treatment, and the neurologist knew very well that beta blocker will work in this way. Anyway, so I gave up on a beta blocker and still dealt with the headaches. Then I was talking about my chronic headaches to another student who happened to be an internist, internal medicine. And she asked me a number of questions about my lifestyle, about my diet, about my sleep, about my exercise. And she noted that I used to get regular exercise, and at this particular time, I was, I don't know, maybe teaching too much or whatever, I wasn't able to get my regular exercise. And she said, you know, maybe it's a lifestyle issue. Maybe you just need to go back and get your regular exercise. And I went back to the regular exercise, headaches gone. Now, the point of this story is each doctor looked at my problem from their own perspective. So the neurologist looked at it from his perspective, and he misdiagnosed it as a migraine. She looked at it in a more general way, and she actually correctly diagnosed it. And just to end this anecdote with a terrible joke, suppose one of my students was a proctologist. What kind of diagnosis would I have gotten? Sorry, it's a silly joke, but it's kind of nice. The point of that anecdote and lousy joke is how we tend to approach problems in life from our very specific standpoints, our personal standpoints. Whatever has worked for me before is going to work in the future. And that doesn't always work. It won't work in dealing with the mind. So Alarka is a great warrior. He is used to conquering his foes by force. Force is not going to work in dealing with his mind in general and anger in particular. This is the message thus far. So, revisit the last half of his verse. He says, Aham mokshyami, I am going to shoot sutikshna agran shayakan. I'm going to shoot my really sharp arrows, manaha prati, towards my mind. Well, guess who's listening to him? He's speaking out loud, sitting at the foot of a tree, thinking. And who's listening to him as he's talking is his mind, and his mind responds. This is allegory. Manahu vacha manahu ne me bhanas tarishyanti ne me bhanas tarish mama larka katanshana mama larka katan tavaiva marma bhetsyanti tavaiva bhar bhinna marma marishyasi bhinna marma. So his mind is now talking to him. His mind is listening to him say, I'm going to shoot arrows towards my mind. And he means it, it's an allegory. So allegorically means he's going to use some very forceful means to arrest the anger of his mind. And his mind replies. He says, ime, we have to break the words, na ime, ime banaha, these arrows, na tarishyanti, will not reach mam, me. Alarka, your arrows will not reach me, katanchana, in any way whatsoever. So the mind is smart enough to know that force is not an appropriate means to deal with the mind in general and anger in particular. And now the mind makes a kind of, in the context of the allegorical story, the mind makes a very obvious observation. He says, Bhetsyanti, your arrows, Bhetsyanti will strike, Bhetsyanti will strike, your arrows will strike, Tava eva marma, your own flesh. The arrows will strike your own flesh, and binna marma, when your flesh is stricken with arrows, manushyasi, you will die. So it's just a fun allegorical story, but you get the message. The mind's response is, if you use force to control your mind, you'll end up injuring yourself in the long run. It'll do more harm than good. When somebody else forces you to do something and you have no choice, you do it. And how do you feel about it? Think about a time when somebody else forced you to do something and you had to do it. You did it. Not happily. You might have been angry or frustrated or hurt. It was not a happy situation whatsoever. So here the point is, if you use force to deal with the problem of anger or any other problem in the mind, you may be somewhat successful, but in the end, it will do more harm than good. You know, in our meditation, many of you were here in a meditation, we talked about the problem of being overly self-critical. Here's the problem. When you make your mind, and I remember Pujya Swami Dayananda talking about this so wonderfully. Look at the problem when you make your own mind an enemy to be conquered. We said your mind is a lifelong companion, and when you treat your mind, your lifelong companion, as an enemy you have to conquer, oh my gosh, then it's like, everywhere you go, you bring your arch enemy with you, your mind, and life becomes a battlefield. The battlefield metaphor of the Bhagavad Gita is pretty obvious. Life becomes a battlefield, certainly, if you make an enemy of your own mind. Every day is a constant battle. And who will win those battles? Don't think that you'll win all those battles. Your mind is so strong, so arrogant, so deeply entrenched in its habits, it's not going to be a happy battle at all. So that's why in this allegory, the mind's response is, if you try to shoot, literally it says, the mind says, if you try to shoot your arrows at me, your arrows will pierce your own flesh and kill you. That's the literal meaning. The allegorical meaning is, if you try to use force to manipulate your own mind, that force will backfire on you. Your mind will resist. Just a very obvious example. How stressful it is when you've made an enemy out of your mind and you're in a constant state of battle and conflict. People talk about stress. Everyone has stressful lives. You have so many demands, so many responsibilities. A lot is on your shoulders, creates a lot of stress, and then if you add to that already existent stress, if you add this other stress from fighting with your own mind, having made your own mind an enemy, the amount of stress can be overwhelming. Intense stress, ask your doctor, chronic stress over a period of years can kill you. That's the metaphor. Allegorically, the arrows can kill you, and the allegorical meaning is chronic stress can kill you. It's quite accurate. All right, let's continue. So now the mind is going to give him some advice as they're continuing their conversation. Anyan banan samikshasva, anyan banan samikshasva, yayastvam ham sudayashyasi, yayastvam ham sudayashyasi. Tachrutva savichintyata, tato vachanam abravit. So the mind is now giving him some advice. The mind says, arrows won't work. Arrows will only hurt yourself, meaning forceful approach will only hurt yourself. Therefore, anyan banan samikshyasva. Samikshyasva, you should look for banan, arrows, anyan, different kind of arrows. Alarka said, I'm going to use really sharp arrows. So the mind says those really sharp arrows will only succeed in piercing your own flesh and killing you. So the mind's response is, well, don't use the really sharp arrows. Use anyan banan, a different kind of arrow, meaning not a forceful approach. Samikshaswa, you should look for anyan banan, different kinds of arrows, not those sharp ones. And yaihi, by which, you should find a different kind of arrow, yaihi, through which tvam, you, sudayishyasi, by which you can kill mam, me. And it doesn't literally mean kill. So the mind is saying you should look for different kinds of arrows by which you can kill me. That's the literal meaning. Allegorical meaning is a forceful approach is not going to be successful in dealing with the mind in general and anger in particular. You should look for another strategy to conquer the mind, to conquer the problem of anger. A forceful approach will not work. You should look for a different kind of strategy. It's like when I was telling the teens, dealing with the screaming one-year-old, shouting won't work, forceful approach won't work. What kind of approach do you use with a crying one-year-old? You give the child a toy, you give it some sweet, you give it some juice, you hug it or whatever you do. you do something nice, not forceful. That's an interesting strategy for your mind. When your mind is misbehaving, what is our typical response? Our typical response is pretty forceful most of the time. And the whole message of this allegory is it's a lousy strategy. Does it work? To an extent. But if it's a strategy that causes more harm than good, what a just a funny example of this. Back in the 19th century, medical science had advanced to such a point that they understood some forms of mental illness were caused by defects in the brain, and one doctor decided that the best way of treating schizophrenia and some other kinds of psychosis, the best form of treatment was this: they sever the nerve bundles in between the two halves. What do they call that? Lobotomy. Frontal lobotomy. They used to do that for real. They'd open up your skull and cut these nerve fibers that connected the left and right halves of the front part of your brain. They did that. Did it work? Sort of. But look at the consequences, the terrible side effects, and of course they eventually abandoned it when they realized it caused far more harm than good. Think about your response to some of your own mistakes. You make a mistake. How do you respond to the mistakes you've made? Sometimes the response is pretty forceful. Does that forceful response work? Sort of. But the point of this allegory is that when you make a mistake and your response is so forceful, can we go back to that? I gave that story in the meditation session, and if you weren't here, the story was, suppose you're at a party and you trip and fall against the buffet table, you end up laying on your back, covered in food, all of your friends are looking at you, aghast at what has happened. As you're laying on your back, what do you tell yourself? The self-talk goes on. And the self-talk is that, oh, too bad. The self-talk could be really harsh, right? What a fool I am. What a clumsy idiot I am. How could I do something so stupid? Now, look at this. That harsh self-talk, if that actually happened to you, and if I were to ask you, why do you engage in such harsh self-talk? You might reply, when one of my teenagers actually gave a reply like this, and the reply was, Swamiji, I have to be harsh with myself to avoid making the mistake again. You've done this. You've made a mistake, and you are incredibly harsh on yourself because you want to ensure that you never make that mistake again. So you, in American English, we have this expression, you beat yourself up emotionally. Means you use this harsh self-criticism to ensure that you will never make a stupid mistake like that again. Now apply it to this party situation. You're laying on your back, covered in food, embarrassed, totally, totally embarrassed. This harsh self-talk is taking place. Why? Is that harsh self-talk necessary to prevent you from making that mistake again? If you don't do that harsh self-talk, the next time you go to a party, you'll definitely lunge at a table and repeat the whole thing again because you failed to do that harsh self-talk. Does that make any sense at all? Of course not. The point I'm making here is that harsh self-talk is counterproductive. When you're laying on your back covered in food, you know very well you've made a mistake, and this harsh self-talk adds insult to injury, as they say. It's not doing any good. In fact, it's making you feel worse. Already you feel embarrassed. And then with his harsh self-talk, you end up feeling even worse. What is the benefit? As we said, it's not necessary for the sake of ensuring you don't make that mistake again. You don't need the harsh self-talk to prevent you from making that mistake again. You're smarter than that. Then where does this harsh self-talk come from? That's the neurologist prescribing beta blockers. It's our usual response to dealing with problems. Our usual response to deal with problems is straight on, deal with it, make sure it doesn't happen again. Pound away against that problem, and that leads to this harsh self-talk, which is damaging. And that's what this allegory is bringing about, is the allegory is teaching us, that this forceful approach to changing the ways our minds behave is a lousy strategy. And so therefore the mind itself says, anyan bhanan samiksha swa, you should look for a different kind of arrow, a different approach, a different strategy for dealing with the mind. Yas yaihi tvam mam sudayishyasi, you should find a different strategy for dealing with me, with the mind, so to speak. Then, alarka tachrutva, having heard what the mind told him, saha vichintya, he thought it over. Ata, and then, tataha, thereafter, vachanam abravit, then he said something else. And what's surprising is the mind has just bawled him out, so to speak, for his lousy strategy. He said, I'm going to shoot sharp arrows at my mind, and the mind says, that's a lousy strategy. Find a different strategy. So what does Alarka do? He decides, his mind is no help. And he starts talking next, not to his mind, he starts talking to his nose. Alarka uvacha, alarka uvacha, agrahya subahun gandhans, agrahya subahun gandhans, thaneva prati gridhyati, thaneva prati gridhyati, tasmad granam prati sharan, tasmad granan prati sharan, pratimokshyamyaham shitan, pratimokshyamyaham. So he's now he's talking to his nose, and his nose, by the way, look at the next verse, grana, the nose replies. So we'll see that later. So in this allegory, now he is done talking to his mind is no help. The mind didn't give him he's ready to shoot arrows. And that's all he knows how to do. So he rejects, interesting how the allegory works. He rejects the good advice of his mind. His mind suggests, don't use force, use a different strategy. He rejects that. Tells us something. We have a tendency to reject other ways of dealing with our own problems. We've dealt with our problems so long using these forceful methodologies, and that's all we know how to do. So if somebody suggests, well, maybe you should consider doing something else, and our response might be, no, I know what I'm doing. Don't tell me what to do. Anyway, that's what Alarka is doing here. So he ignores his mind, and he starts talking to his nose, which agrahya, O nose, you, agrahya, having smelled gandhan, many fragrances, subahun gandhan, having smelled many beautiful smells, many beautiful fragrances, nose and nose, taneva, those fragrances, pratigridhyati, the nose wants more. The nose is greedy for more. The nose has smelled so many wonderful things, and the nose is not satisfied. You see the flow of the text. First, he's complaining about my mind. My mind is never satisfied. As many kingdoms as I conquer, my mind wants to conquer more. Now he's complaining about his nose. My nose has smelled so many wonderful fragrances, and taneva pratigridhyati, and my mind and my nose is ready for still more. Tasmat, therefore, Alarka says, drop down a line, prati mokshyami aham, I, prati mokshyami, I will free, meaning I will shoot, shitan, sharan, up a line. I will shoot sharan, arrows, which are shitan, sharpened. I will shoot sharpened arrows where? Granam prati. Granam. Prati. So first he says, I'm going to shoot my sharp arrows towards my mind. Now he says, I'm going to shoot these sharpened arrows towards my nose. Of course, it's an allegory. Don't take it literally. The point is, and we'll see this when we meet next time, is his forceful approach to dealing with the mind is not going to be successful. So he says, well, instead of fighting with my mind, let me fight with my senses. Grana, the sense of smell, is the first of five senses. It's actually the most primal of our senses. And so now, instead of doing battle with his mind, he's going to do battle with his senses. And I think we'll see that battle when we meet next time and continue our allegory. Okay, a couple of quick announcements. Tomorrow, Sunday, at 11 o'clock, we have our usual program for children. And as I mentioned before, once a month, I conduct an advanced meditation session. Advanced meditation is tomorrow at 6 p.m. Also, let me mention, I've just posted a new video. These videos are getting a little popular. It's nice. I get a lot of very positive feedback. The last one, lots of positive feedback. The topic is puja. The introduction is, do Hindus really worship idols? Bear in mind that in Western culture, idol means a false god. So anyway, starting with that misconception, it deals with puja, deals with the worship of sacred forms on an altar, and gives the symbolism involved in the performance of puja. That video is available. You can find it on our website. You can find it on YouTube. And here's my, as I requested before, the more of you who watch my videos, that causes YouTube to promote the videos more widely. That's the way it works. They call it an algorithm. YouTube uses an algorithm. The way the algorithm works is your videos will be promoted according to how many views it gets. So when you watch these videos, you actually help promote the videos to others. So please look at watch the videos. Invite your friends who might be interested to watch the videos. Also, as long as you're watching the video, there's that button for thumbs up. You should click that button for thumbs up and leave a comment. That all helps. So please take a look. So it's called "Do Hindus Really Worship Idols?" is the title of that new video. The library will be open after class, and we'll conclude with our prayers.